Good morning. Thank you for accommodating our change to the Allison Auditorium. I'm John Hilbolt, Director of Lectures and Seminars, and it's my privilege to welcome you to our Allison Auditorium, to welcome those joining us via the heritage.org website, and those who are also joining us via C-SPAN on tape. We would ask one courtesy as we officially start that everyone checks that cell phones and pagers have been turned off to avoid any electronic interference in the room. I know our taping crew will especially appreciate that. We, of course, remind our Internet viewers that questions can be submitted to us via email addressed to speaker@heritage.org. Hosting our program is Dr. Ariel Cohen. Dr. Cohen serves as our Senior Research Fellow for Russia and Eurasian Studies and International Energy Security in our Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies. He is a native of Yalta, earned his Ph.D. at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. His expertise ranges from economic development and political reform in the former Soviet republics to the global war on terror, the continuing conflict in the Middle East, and U.S. energy security. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, the International Institute on Strategic Studies in London, and the American Association for the Advancement of Slavic Studies. Ladies and gentlemen, my colleague, Ariel Cohen. Ariel.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to host our speakers today and to host all of you here at the Heritage Foundation. I also want to welcome the C-SPAN viewers and our viewers on the Internet. These are difficult days in the Middle East. The war is going on for 14 days. It's a difficult conflict because no easy solutions are in sight. Secretary Rice was shuttling between Lebanon and Israel, and I believe today she is in Rome at an international conference. We are here to take a look at Hezbollah and its sponsors, and the panel to do that is extremely highly qualified. We'll start with Aaron Manis, who is my neighbor. Aaron is a terrorism researcher at University of Maryland and a writer. In addition to authoring Profiles in Terror, available at Amazon.com, he has written on the Middle East affairs and terrorism for numerous publications, including Policy Review, The Wall Street Journal, Europe, Jerusalem Post, and others. He was a director of research at Middle East Media Research Institute, Memory, which is known to you probably as memory.org, the primary resource for Middle Eastern media in translation. He'll be followed by Patrick Lawson. Patrick is Deputy Director for Research of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. His previous positions included being a senior research professor at the National Defense University and author of many books, including Reducing Vulnerability to Middle East Energy Shocks, a Key Element in Strengthening U.S. Energy Security, published last year. Patrick has a Ph.D. from New School for Social Research and B.A. Oberlin College. Last but not least, one of the most famous names in Middle East studies, Daniel Pipes, who is a director of Middle East Forum and a prize-winning columnist. He has appeared in the New York Sun and other American publications. And abroad, he appears weekly in Israel's Jerusalem Post, Italy's L'Opinione, Spain's La Razón, and in many other publications. He got his A.B. in 71 from Harvard University, Ph.D. in 78 from Harvard University, both in history. He spent 6 years studying abroad, including 3 years in Egypt. We could not ask for better resources to address this complicated issue. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll start with Aaron Manis.
Thank you. It is an honor to be on a panel with my fellow distinguished panelists. So I want to begin with a very focused talk about who Hezbollah is and why they're a threat not just to Israel, not just the United States, but to the world. When former U.S. Undersecretary of State Richard Armitage called Hezbollah the A-team of international terrorism, he was not, as he sometimes was wont to do, giving in to hyperbole. They are the A-team of terrorism. When you're evaluating a terrorist organization, It's not just a matter of numbers. It's not just a matter of equipment. It's not just a matter of rhetoric. It's a matter of skills. And when we look at Hezbollah, we see an organization that has very high skills at delivering mayhem, at attacking its opponents in sensitive political spots, and most ominously, and I'll get to that, at transferring its skills to other organizations. Hezbollah is a triple threat. They are an effective guerrilla organization. We're seeing that right now as they're fighting the Israelis and giving, unfortunately, an able account of themselves. They are an effective social and political organization, and they are an effective international terrorist organization. And I want to flesh out each of these a little bit. As a guerrilla organization, it's not just a matter of counting rockets. As frightening as their rockets are, it's their ability to use them. Possessing sophisticated anti-ship missiles is one thing. Using them effectively to hit a modern warship is another. That's not just a message to Israel. That's a message to the United States and the Persian Gulf. They spent 15 years fighting an insurgency against Israel. They showed a continuing ability to learn from their mistakes, to adapt to Israeli tactics, to take advantage of vulnerabilities. And I'll just point out one particular tactic they developed that we're hearing a lot about now, the IED. This is nothing new. It started in southern Lebanon. They were using it against Israeli tanks over a decade ago. They shared this experience with the Palestinian terrorist groups who have, again, used it all too effectively against Israeli tanks. And at one point in October 2003, against a convoy of American diplomats. Hezbollah has since opened offices in southern Iraq. I don't think I'm making too much of a leap to say that there is an Iranian and Hezbollah hand in the devastating IEDs we're encountering in Iraq. They are also an effective social and political organization. This is not to legitimate them. Many terrorist groups have social and political wings. They are not a good thing that the organization does in addition to the terror. They are part and parcel of the terror itself. The social organization provides logistical support. It helps recruit. For example, they run youth soccer leagues. Well, what better place to see who might be an effective future recruit than in a soccer league? They run hospitals. They run funds for the widows and orphans. But these are the widows and orphans of their fighters killed in combat. So they're just reinforcing their purpose. Same thing with the political wing. It gives them a veneer of respectability, which too many people here accept. There have been articles talking about Hezbollah converting to a political party for almost since the organization first appeared in the late 80s. Well, it's almost 20 years later. I'm still waiting. We accept this argument that they have a certain level of political popularity, but they're the only armed militia left in Lebanon. You think that doesn't help their get-out-the-vote drive a little bit? When they're disarmed, let them run for office, and then we can judge. By the way, it's important to note some of the bloodiest fighting Hezbollah did was against the rival Shiite political party, Amal. In 1990, they massacred 700 Amal members, and they were desecrating the bodies. And at this point, their spiritual guide, Muhammad Fadlallah, stepped in and said, this is wrong, this is inappropriate. Let me just say, when you have a situation where Muhammad Fadlallah is the voice of reason, you are in a very, very frightening place. They also run, as we all now know, a satellite channel, Al-Manar, that frankly makes Al Jazeera look like CNN. Al-Manar has become the model for other terrorist groups. Hamas is trying to start a satellite channel. The Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood is starting a satellite channel. The Tamil Tigers off in Southeast Asia are starting a satellite channel. They have radio. They develop video games to promote their cause. They have a well-oiled propaganda machine. They are very good at getting their message out. Crowds in Egypt are marching with portraits of Nasrallah, despite their own government's opposition to Hezbollah's moves. They're effective as a political and social organizer. Finally, there's the international terror. Prior to 9/11, they were the number one international terrorist killers of Americans. But it's not just the mayhem. They have a knack for hitting in ways that leave deep political scars. Their first major international terror attack was against the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, which in addition to killing 60 people, in addition to just the sheer murder, wiped out the CIA station in Beirut, including the station chief, including the Near East director who happened to be visiting that day. The CIA has never recovered from this loss. Their next major attack was the attack on the U.S. Marines in 1983, which they also hit French troops. They were part of an international peacekeeping force. The United States withdrew. This sent a message to the entire Arab world that if you hit America, if you cause them to bleed, America will leave. It's something we've never recovered from. It also left Lebanon in the hands of Syria and Iran, and they have gone on, as we will discuss further, to provide enormous support to Hezbollah, logistically, financially, and in skills. And, of course, there was Iran-Contra, where kidnapping Americans and French citizens in Britain led to massive political scandals both in the United States and in France, time and time again. By the way, I have a piece. You can access it at National Review Online about their attack on the AMIA building in Argentina. Same story. So what we see is an organization that is capable of tremendous violence in its own right, and time again, it shares its capabilities. And with the international terrorism, there's a particularly chilling note. Their lead operative for international affairs is Imad Bugnaya. You may have never heard of him, but he is the most dangerous terrorist you've never heard of. He masterminded most of Hezbollah's major operations. Interestingly, he got a start working for Yasser Arafat's 417 in Beirut in the late 70s.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, it was a real, it was like the Harvard, I guess 417 was the Harvard of terrorism. In the mid-90s, Mugnaya met with bin Laden, and bin Laden shared his respect for Mugnaya's work. He was impressed with Mugnaya's attack on the Marines that drove America out of Lebanon. That was the beginning of a Hezbollah-Al-Qaeda alliance. We saw a dramatic improvement in Al-Qaeda's operational capabilities after that meeting, and here again, we're still paying the price for that around the world. So I just want to finish up before we get to our very distinguished other panelists by saying if the present crisis creates an opportunity to remove Hezbollah from the international scene, Israel, the world, the United States will all be much safer, and I hope we take this opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron. Now it's Patrick Lawson.
Well, Aaron was describing to you what an impressive force Hezbollah has become in Lebanese politics and international terrorism. The question then arises, how did this happen? How is it that Hezbollah was able to become such an important player on the Lebanese political scene and such a sophisticated force in international terrorism? Is it because of Hezbollah's dedication, its ideology? Is it because its message has been particularly well received by the people that it speaks to? Well, it's possible that all of those played a role. But the single most important factor has been the massive resources that's been provided to Hezbollah by the Iranian government. It was the Iranian government which explicitly ordered the creation of Hezbollah as an organization, which, and this is not a matter of which there is any dispute in the scholarly community or among the friends of Hezbollah in the academic community or in Lebanon, or for that matter, from the Iranian officials. They will acknowledge that in a situation in which the Lebanese Shia community in the early 1980s was starting to become politically active after decades of political quiescence and was becoming an important element in the social and economic as well as political scene in Lebanon, Iran stepped in to make sure that the most radical elements within the Lebanese Shia community were the ones who won out. They provided financing and training to those radical elements, ordered them to at first pretend that they were still acting within the framework of what was then the largest Lebanese Shia organization, Amal, and then to split that organization and to create Hezbollah. As you heard from Aaron, Hezbollah went on to indeed massacre 700 members of the Amal organization. The victory of Hezbollah within the Lebanese Shia community was by no means foreordained by the viewpoints of Lebanese Shia. Quite the contrary. It was because Iran provided the arms and indeed the soldiers through the presence at that time of several hundred Iranian Revolutionary Guard members who were helpful, to put it mildly, to Hezbollah in this campaign, bloody campaign, to establish its dominance within the Shia community. And to this day, Hezbollah makes it extremely difficult for anybody in the Shia community who wants to run the most simple the most simple economic enterprise, which is not controlled by Hezbollah and its members. You want to run a factory, Hezbollah's going to have a say in who gets hired there and in everything that happens in the operations if you're in the Lebanese Shia community. The idea, therefore, that Hezbollah is popular in the Lebanese Shia community, well, Hezbollah, by its very own action, shows that it doesn't believe that, because it says that without its arms, it would be nothing. I agree. I quite agree with them. Without its arms, it would be nothing. And where do those arms come from? The answer is they came from Iran. Iran has provided Hezbollah with an impressive arsenal, and more importantly, with impressive training. Guerrilla groups like Hamas, like the Palestine Liberation Organizations of Fatah, would have been delighted to have the intense, hands-on, detailed training that the Iranian Revolutionary Guards and Minister of Internal Security people have provided Hezbollah over the years. There's a reason that Hezbollah is so professional. It's had professional help. It's had help which any other terrorist group would be delighted to have had. Hezbollah has had the kind of detailed training, the kind of interactive evaluation of what happens in operations so that they can be refined and improved, which would be the dream of any other terrorist organization, which doesn't have the resources of a state to provide the safe haven, the places where the new techniques can be tried out, practiced, and where operations can be evaluated. There's a reason why Hezbollah is the best fighting force in the Arab world. And I say that without any reservations. It's the best fighting force in the Arab world. It's because one of the most serious armies in the entire Middle East, namely the Iranians, stand behind them and have provided them with extensive assistance. And sophisticated arms. I was quite impressed looking at this week's issue of Defense News, a respected American weekly. And they had a list there of some 25 rocket systems that Hezbollah has been provided. Quite an impressive list. Well, it's not just that Hezbollah has been trained and armed and created by Iran. We have to ask the question of for whose benefit does Hezbollah act? Hezbollah has often tried to present itself as having Iranian support in the past, but now it's become a real actor on the Lebanese scene and a Lebanese party. Well, those who say that Hezbollah is a Lebanese party have to ask the question of, well, when there are conflicts between the Lebanese agenda of Hezbollah and the Iranian-supported agenda of Hezbollah, who wins? And the answer is, time after time, what Hezbollah does is in the interests of Iran and not in the interests of advancing its cause on the Lebanese political scene. We have seen this repeatedly. And indeed, I was intrigued that a friend of mine, Fred Hoff, a noted expert about Lebanon, who's been often optimistic about how Hezbollah is going to become a Lebanese force, was speaking at the Middle East Institute the other day. And if you don't know, the Middle East Institute is, shall we say, an organization not noted for being on the right wing in the political spectrum and not noted for being overly friendly towards U.S. policy in the Middle East. But Mr. Hoff, when addressing this question, he said that Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, and his inner circle do what they do first and foremost to defend and to project the existence and power of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The diplomatic center of gravity is located in Tehran, not in some bunker in the southern suburbs of Beirut. Nowhere is that more clear than in the actions of the last few weeks, where what Nasrallah has done is brought down death and destruction upon the Shia community and upon Lebanon, and you have to ask the basic question, who has benefited from this? 3 weeks ago, the international community's agenda, as we prepared for the St. Petersburg summit, right smack top and center of what was those discussions, was going to be what to do about Iran's nuclear program. That was expected to be one of the major issues. Indeed, many of the news analyses leading up to the St. Petersburg summit said it was going to be the leading issue at that summit. Instead, it got less than an hour, well under an hour discussion by the leaders because of the concentration on the events in Lebanon. Very few people are paying attention to the Security Council discussion, which is due to start in the next few days, about a resolution ordering Iran to suspend its nuclear program, requiring Iran to accept additional international inspections, and indeed threatening Iran with sanctions if it does not. The agenda has changed. Another way of examining Iran's role in this current crisis is to take a look at what it is that Iranian leaders and Iranian media are saying about this current situation. To say that their coverage of the matter is unbalanced would be extraordinarily charitable. The representative of Hezbollah in Iran held a press conference late last week in which he explained that there's been only two Hezbollah fighters killed, and meanwhile 5.1 million Israelis have fled, like the cowards they are, from the Hezbollah rockets raining down upon Israel. That does not sound like a man who's about ready to accept a ceasefire. And meanwhile, the Iranian television network is repeatedly running 3-minute infomercials explaining why people should boycott Zionist products and explaining that Pepsi is actually an acronym for Put Every Penny to Save Israel. I mean, I'm not making this up. And Ahmadinejad was reflecting the reporting in the Iran when he says that Israel is on its last legs and that Hezbollah is about to achieve the historic victory of the elimination of the Zionist entity from the Middle East. Well, that in some ways shows what is at stake here. If the Iranian hardliners believe that a confrontational approach of Hezbollah achieves this great victory, what do you think they're going to do if their nuclear program advances? What does this say to us about what Iran will do if it has nuclear capabilities? If they come to the conclusion that a confrontational approach can achieve this kind of historic victory long deprived to their co-thinkers in the Middle East, what do you think they would do with nuclear weapons? It's a sobering thought, to put it mildly. On the other hand, within Iran, those who are scared by the confrontational approach of the current crowd have been using this situation to say, look what can happen to a country which seems to be prosperous and at peace, and suddenly all of that can disappear and suffering can be inflicted on its people as war rains down on their heads in a very quick turn of things. And perhaps we in Iran should learn a lesson from this. And that has been the character of coverage in the main remaining reformist newspaper, Shark. Very interesting debate going on between Shark and Kayhan, the main hardline newspaper, about this matter. And what that shows is just how much is at stake here in this crisis. If, in fact, the crisis is resolved in a way that Hezbollah is perceived throughout the world, throughout the region, to have achieved a victory, that will have sobering lessons for what will happen with Iran's nuclear program. On the other hand, if the crisis ends with what is perceived as a defeat for Hezbollah, and an illustration of what happens when you follow too confrontational a policy, that will have very reassuring consequences. For in Iran, there has, until now, been quite a debate in elite circles about whether the nuclear program is too risky to pursue, or whether Iran might be well advised to freeze the program until a better moment. And indeed, I'm concerned that how this crisis is resolved, this crisis regarding Hezbollah's attacks in Lebanon is resolved, will do much to determine what will happen with an Iranian nuclear threat, not only to the region, but to the world.
Thank you, Patrick. I think that Iranian aspect cannot be overemphasized. Now to Dan Pipes.
I will build on my colleague's comments, telling you about Hezbollah and telling you about Iran. I will talk about the crisis in Lebanon and American policy. And I'd like to take as my proof text an anonymous quotation from this morning's New York Times from an American official. There will be an international force in Lebanon because the key players want it. So keep that in mind. I'd like to make 2 points. First, a historical point about Lebanon, and specifically Lebanon and Israel. The drama that is unfolding in front of us these days is by no means the first round. This is a problem that has been afflicting Israel, that is to say, the attacks from Lebanon, attacks across the border, as in the killing of 8 soldiers and the abduction of 2, or subsequently the raining down of missiles, has been something that Israel has gone through before. The PLO moved to Lebanon. Well, the PLO became important in Lebanon as a force after 1967 and particularly after 1970 when it was expelled from Jordan. The Israelis tried to address this time and time again. And they used their traditional method, which is to focus on getting a responsible party to stop the terrorism. They did this in the 1950s with Jordan, Egypt, and Syria, and they did it with great success. The Jordanian, Egyptian, and Syrian governments reined in and controlled the would-be terrorists. And indeed, this was the first... This was something that Ariel Sharon became famous for doing. The Israelis tried this in Lebanon. For example, in 1969, they attacked the Beirut airport, just as they did 2 weeks ago. But it didn't work, because in Lebanon there was no address, there was no strong central government, no government that had a monopoly of force. You heard about Hezbollah as a militia, but at that time there were many others, including the PLO force and the Kataib, the Falangist force of the Maronite community. The tensions of the attacks, that resulted from the attacks on Israel, led to, in some fashion, was a major factor in the 1975 breakout of civil war. The Israelis responded in 1978 with the Litani operation, which they took a part of Lebanon, South Lebanon, for a brief period. And the result of that was the creation of UNIFIL, a United Nations force that has been in southern Lebanon since that time. In 1982, they undertook a very major operation of war, not that dissimilar from the present one. It started in the same way. There was an attack on an Israeli, the ambassador to London. He was not killed, but he was attacked, and the Menachem Begin government took this and said, this is unacceptable, we're going to extirpate the PLO. They occupied a good part of Lebanon up to Beirut, and they continued to occupy a small part of Lebanon for the next 18 years, the so-called security zone. They left most of it but kept a small part. Their going into Lebanon was what led to the emergence of Hezbollah in 1982. Finally, the Israelis left on their own accord in 2000, but under pressure from Hezbollah because Israeli soldiers were being killed and a social movement developed in Israel that said no more Israeli deaths in Lebanon, and the Israelis left. Now, there have been periods of calm, in particular the last 6 years have been relatively calm, but the structural problem remains. There is no Beirut address. There is no constituted powerful government that can say to Hezbollah, no, stop this. We will insist that you stop this. We will force you to stop this. Indeed, if one looks at the Lebanese armed force, the official army of Lebanon, one will see that a substantial part of it is Shiite and has sympathies with Hezbollah. So this structural problem has been there since the late 60s vis-a-vis Israel and continues to be there today. Second point is about the alternatives. You remember my initial quote, an international force will come into being. That is the policy of the United States as articulated by Secretary Rice, and the Israelis are saying they, for the first time ever, I believe, are quite happy to have an international force as well. Let's go through the various possibilities, starting with international force. First, the first problem of an international force, meaning a force of major powers, is that no one is eager to do this. The U.S. government is saying, we're stretched. The other major governments are saying, no, thank you, for one reason or another. So it's a little dubious on that ground. But even more important is that this has been tried before, ladies and gentlemen. This was tried in 1982, 1983. It was then called the multinational force. This time it's called the international force, but it's the same thing. And I need only recall to you that the French and American embassies were bombed, the American Marine barracks were bombed with 241 deaths, and we left. It didn't work. And the reason it didn't work is that we weren't willing to fight Hezbollah. It's not our fight. We left. I don't think there's any future for an international force. I think our policymakers should take some time to go back and see how this did not work in 82, 83. Second idea is a UNIFIL sort of force of Fijians and others from small powers. But UNIFIL has not been a success. The Israelis see it as something that's in their way. It does not protect them. It makes it more difficult to patrol the border. Third possibility is having the Lebanese armed forces take over. But as I've explained to you, that's not a possibility. There is no chance of Lebanese armed forces having the strength required to go in, push Hezbollah aside, and control this territory. Fourth possibility is Syrian forces. Obviously unacceptable to Israel to have one of their main enemies have a new front with them at the north of their country. Fifth possibility is Israeli forces, as they did in 1982 and subsequently, control the south of the country of Lebanon. They're not willing to do that. They've learned the lesson that that won't work. So here are five completely unacceptable or impossible possibilities, alternatives. Let me suggest a sixth, and I don't suggest it with any particular enthusiasm, but I see it as the least bad of all the alternatives, and that is to look to Damascus as the address, not invite the Syrians into South Lebanon, but to say to the Syrians, you are responsible for what has happened here, what is happening, and what will happen, and you're responsible for a simple reason. Although, as Patrick pointed out, the Iranians are the main force behind Hezbollah, the Iranians have no access to Lebanon other than through Syria. And were the Syrians to cut that access off, the Iranian role in Lebanon would quickly crumble. It is the, and in addition, the Syrians have their own admiration for and support for Hezbollah. The Syrians constitute an address. The Syrians can be held responsible for what has, is, and will take place in Lebanon. And I do believe it is in our interest to focus on Syria. And indeed, this is not inconsistent with our policy. President Bush gave a speech, or gave a radio address on Saturday in which he pointed to the Syrian involvement. Now, look at Syria for a moment. Syria has been ruled for 6 years by Bashar al-Assad. He is not Hafez al-Assad. He is not the tactical genius his father was. He is a bumbler. He is incompetent. He's made mistake after mistake. This has two implications. First, it is favorable to us in that he has isolated Syria in a way that never was before under his father's rule. He has good relations with the Turks, obviously with the Iranians, with the Shia of Lebanon, and with the Palestinians. But he has bad relations with the Lebanese, most the non-Shiite Lebanese, the Israelis, the Iraqis, the Egyptians, Saudis, Jordan, France, and the United States. There is a significant group of countries that are unhappy with Syrian behavior. The difficulty in Bashar's incompetence is that you don't know what he's going to do. It's hard to make plans when your opponent is incompetent. Stupidity leads to surprises. My recommendation is that the U.S. take the diplomatic lead in trying to blame and isolate and put the focus on Syria. It would be nice to split the Syrians from Iran, but that's not my goal here. My goal is to hold the Syrians responsible for the influx of arms, of expertise, of money, personnel to South Lebanon and say, any trouble there, you will hear about it. And the Israelis should be making that a fact. They should growl at the rulers in Damascus and make it clear that this is unacceptable, that the Syrians will pay for this. And this is not without precedent. In Sharon's prime ministry between 2001 and 2005, he attacked the Syrian military on two different occasions to send them a message. This is unacceptable. I think this would work in the future. Let me conclude by recalling an incident in 1998. The Turks, who had problems with the Syrian government for years and years, for many reasons, but in particular because the Syrians hosted the leader of the main terrorist group in Turkey, the PKK. And Abdullah Öcalan, the leader of the PKK, was living openly in Damascus. In fact, my journal interviewed him there, the Middle East Quarterly, in about 97. And the Turks, who are very fractious, politically came together in 1998 in September and agreed across the spectrum that this was intolerable. And they started moving forces to the border. And within days, the regime of Hafez al-Assad got the message and expelled Öcalan, who subsequently was arrested by the Turks and now languishes in his own prison on a Turkish island. As the Israeli analyst Ephraim Inbar wrote a few days ago, the Israelis should start speaking Turkish to the Syrians. Thank you.
Thank you. I think the context for the current conflict was laid out. I would just add that both in my article on Monday in the Washington Times and in Tech Central Station, I submit that this is not the time for a ceasefire. When you are in the front lines of the war on terror and you're fighting the A-team of the terrorist camp, the last thing you do is stop before you finish the job. And it's not in American interests to push Israel now into a ceasefire that Israel will lose because of. The ceasefire now will allow Hezbollah and its sponsors, both in Damascus and Tehran, to claim victory. Israel is executing its right for self-defense. It was attacked across an international border, and the UN Security Council Resolution 1559 has not been implemented, not by the government of Lebanon and not by the United Nations. So for Kofi Annan now to call for the immediate ceasefire is disingenuous at best. We shall open for questions and answers. The rules are the following. Please identify yourself, wait for the mic, and ask a question and keep it short. Thank you. Dan, you want to ask a question? Okay.
I have two questions for Patrick.
All right.
Any chance of biological and chemical? And secondly, you ascribed this crisis to the Iranians, but everyone from Hezbollah to the Iranians has said this came as a complete surprise to them. They had no idea that the Israelis would respond to what they saw as a fairly routine cross-border infraction in the way they did. So maybe it was the Israeli decision rather than an Iranian decision.
First of all, on the chemical and biological weapons, it's not clear how advanced our Iranian capabilities. And I've seen no indications that they have transferred any of those capabilities to Hezbollah. I would be concerned that under Bashar Assad, the Syrians have transferred quite a number of missile systems to Hezbollah and have equipped those missiles with a number of rather nasty anti-personnel devices the Israelis didn't know about. That is a concern because the Syrians are known to have quite sophisticated chemical weapon systems on top of missiles. So if I were worried about chemical warheads on missiles, I'd be much more concerned about the Syrian front than the Iranian. Not clear the Iranians have gone that route. And I would just simply say that as for who provoked this crisis, I don't know. But I do think that Iran anticipated that a situation in which Israel looked helpless, unable to get back its prisoners, and in which the Iranians anticipated that the Europeans would be coming to Iran to ask for their intermediation to provide assistance in securing the release of these prisoners. After all, that's what the United States did. It's faced with a similar situation in the 1980s, is ask Iran to help with the release. That would be provide Iran with a useful opportunity to say to the Europeans, fine, we'll agree to do that. If in return you will agree to do something for us, wouldn't it be nice if the UN Security Council discussion about our nuclear program was postponed, at least for some months, if not indefinitely? So I think we can say that Iran would have benefited rather substantially in the event of there not being any pronounced Israeli reaction to kidnapping, because Iran still would have expected that it would have played an important negotiating intermediate role.
Can I add one footnote? I mentioned Imad Mughnaya before. When you're a terrorism wonk, you get a little obsessed with this guy. He hasn't appeared in public since 1995. A picture of him was with Hassan Nasrallah. He popped up in Damascus in January. at Ahmadinejad's side and apparently meeting with Hamas leaders. Like you, I'm unprepared to make certain conclusions about who did what, but that certainly strikes me as very interesting.
We have a question from one of the online viewers. Matthew from Tyson's Corner is asking, some claim Israel's battle with Hezbollah is an opening move in a larger war against Iran yet to unfold. Your thoughts, Patrick?
Well, it's certainly striking that the Iranian leadership has persuaded itself up until recently that there was no military option against Iran's nuclear program because Iran had such potent retaliatory weapons, of which Hezbollah's rockets aimed at Israel were right up there at the top of the list. And if, in fact, the outcome of the current crisis is the elimination of that kind of a threat, then, indeed, Iran has lost a powerful deterrent against military action aimed at its nuclear program. Furthermore, Iran had persuaded itself that the West in general, and Israel in addition, lacked the will to take strong measures which risked retaliation in return in order to stop attacks. And the Israeli action must give some pause to people in Tehran about whether or not that is the case. So, indeed, depending on how this crisis is resolved, there is a real potential for persuading Iran that that there is a military option against Iran's nuclear program. And I'm firmly convinced that diplomacy works best when it's backed up by a credible threat of force in the event that a diplomatic solution is not reached. And I'm firmly convinced that any kind of face-saving compromise or incentives for the Iranians will work much better if Iran is scared about what happens in the event that no agreement is reached.
Diplomacy 101. We studied it. Let's start in the back, please. Please identify yourself and ask a question.
I'm Rafi Danziger and from APAC, and my question is addressed to Patrick. Kind of similar to Daniel's question, Nasrallah has announced that he will now hit Israel south of Haifa. And that suggests the use of heavier, more sophisticated, with much heavier payload missiles than have been used until now, Zilzal missiles. Now, I've seen reports that it's not really likely you'll be able to use them because Zilzal is a big system. You have to put out a truck, takes time, so it will be able to demolish it before it happens. Do you think that they really have an option of hitting targets south of Haifa?
Well, what we saw with the Hezbollah attack on an Israeli ship using a missile system that the Israelis were not aware that Hezbollah had, it is a concerning example of Hezbollah's long history of pulling surprises by having new weapon systems and new capabilities that had previously not been known about. A few years ago, for instance, Hezbollah sent an unmanned aerial vehicle over Israel and taking pictures, and then afterwards showed on Al-Manar television the pictures that it took. Again, a weapon system that Israel had not been aware that Hezbollah had. So in addition to being concerned about the systems that we know Hezbollah has, such as the Zelzal missile, it's quite a long-range missile and carries a very heavy payload, I'm at least as much concerned about what capabilities they have that we're not yet aware of. However, it would seem that so far that Hezbollah has actually committed to this battle everything that it's got, and that they tried to use their Zelzal missiles unsuccessfully. Therefore, it's possible that Hezbollah has thrown its worst at us conventionally. That would still leave the possibility that Hezbollah would renew what it did in the 1990s, namely to engage in terrorist attacks on a worldwide basis. Back then, it attacked an Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires, the Jewish Community Center in Buenos Aires, the Israeli embassy in Bangkok. And Hezbollah has been said by the FBI to have teams of terrorist operatives capable of carrying out terrorist activities here in the United States. So this is a matter of some considerable concern to the U.S. government.
In the middle, please. Yeah, here.
Hi, I'm Deborah Weiss, and I have two quick questions.
Do you have an affiliation?
Well, I work for Right March, but I'm here on my own behalf.
Okay.
I write a lot on this subject. My question is, do any of you have any comments about the Free Patriotic Movement's Memorandum of Understanding with Hezbollah that was made shortly before the outbreak of the war? And the second question is Israel sending the wrong message now by weakening its goal? It's saying that its goal is to weaken the military wing of Hezbollah rather than to get rid of it, and by being open to diplomacy.
Who would like to start?
Well, I'm not sure about the ins and outs of Lebanese politics. As for whether Israel's sending the wrong message, you know, from my perspective, Israel would be doing the world a great favor if they wiped Hezbollah off the face of the earth. However, it's very easy for me to sit in Washington and advise that Israel's going to pay a very high price in that. I fear that Hezbollah has a lot of surprises left. They've been going head-to-head against Israel for a long time. They've been planning for this day since Israel left, building fortifications. Israel had a proxy army in South Lebanon, the South Lebanese army. A substantial percentage of it was actually Shiite. This is a little-known fact. When Israel withdrew, a lot of these guys had little choice, and they signed up with Hezbollah. So now Hezbollah has an excellent insight into how the IDF operates, its tactics, its procedures. So I think Israel would pay a very heavy price. Whether they're prepared to pay such a price, it doesn't appear that they are.
Yes, right here.
Aubrey Murphy from the Heritage Foundation. My question is about the long-term strategy of Israeli politics in the region. When Dr. Rice was in the Middle East, she was talking about reshaping the Middle East. And Dr. Cohen, you used in your language wanting to finish the job. And Mr. Manis, you said wanting to rid the world of Hezbollah. I'm wondering if that can be accomplished through military action, especially in the last 2 weeks, Hezbollah's strong military showing, which you've talked about, or if the military action can be simultaneously carried out, I guess, with also negotiations with Syria, as you were talking about, Mr. Pipes. Syria has called or requested direct talks with the U.S., and if you think that's feasible, and if you think that military action needs to stop in order for direct talks with Syria to be viable, or if both can happen simultaneously. Thank you.
What I'm suggesting, or what the implications of what I'm suggesting, is that it would be far more effective for the Israelis to address the Syrians and say, this better stop. Do what you have to do to stop it now and in the future, than for the Israelis to try and extirpate every last missile, go after every last member of Hezbollah. We're seeing that the results are not as good as they would hope, and we're also seeing that the damage to Lebanese infrastructure and civilians is considerable. There is already a backlash that's occurred around the world. Presumably it will begin to occur in Israel as well. There was a poll yesterday shown in USA Today which showed a crushing majority of Americans sympathetic to Israel, 0.5% sympathetic to Hezbollah, and something in the order of 90% sympathetic to Israel. But if you look closer at that 90%, on the order of 30% say all out what Israel is doing is fine, but close to 60% saying the Israelis have gone too far. And that number is only going to increase, I believe, and will increase in intensity as well as quantity. So the Israelis would be well off, from my point of view, to restrict their activities in Lebanon and hold the Syrians accountable for it.
Yes, ma'am, right here.
Jin Suk Lee, NBC, South Korea. It seems that Hezbollah has operated in Lebanon as a government within a government, and I would like to know what the position of the Lebanese central government has been about Hezbollah, especially if Hezbollah has been operated with the support by a foreign government. And is it that Hezbollah or the Iranian government, the Lebanese government has zero influence or control over Hezbollah?
There was an interesting development about 4 days ago when the Prime Minister of Lebanon was quoted in Corriere della Sera, the Italian newspaper, lightly criticizing Hezbollah and calling it, as you just did, a state within a state. Rather quickly, his office denied that he'd said that, that it was taken out of context, it was misunderstood. And I think there you see the dilemma. The Lebanese government is frustrated that it cannot do anything, is unhappy with this war that's been brought on to them without their having any say in the matter, and yet at the same time is unwilling to criticize Hezbollah because it is Hezbollah that has the greatest military power in the country. So the Lebanese government today, as throughout the last century, since it came into being as a modern force in the 1920s, is not a military force and is a social and educational and other structure, but it's not a military structure. And there are no prospects of that changing.
It was also interesting that a couple of days ago, one of the Hezbollah leaders, I do not remember who it was, said that they informed the Lebanese government that they are going to kidnap Israeli soldiers. My question is, if I was advising the State Department, to go find out what was the reaction of the Lebanese government to that informing.
Next question. Right here.
Hi, good morning, Olivier Guita. I'm an independent consultant on foreign affairs. Two quick questions. The first one, what would happen to Hezbollah's capabilities if Nasrallah and Mugniyeh were to be killed? That's the first one. The second one is, would Iran push Hezbollah, if it was capable of, to attack Tel Aviv?
As valuable as removing Nasrallah and Mugniyeh would be, they at this point probably have a pretty deep bench. They've lost top leaders before and retained all of their capabilities. Nasrallah's predecessor, Mousawi, was assassinated by Israel, and Hezbollah responded rapidly by hitting the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires. So they've got a deep bench. You wouldn't need peeling off the top layer of leadership would be insufficient. You'd need to go a couple of levels down on their org chart. As for targeting Tel Aviv, tough to say. I think that would be opening up. Seeing the will that Israel's exerting at this point might open up some dangerous possibilities for Iran, so they might prefer to play it cautiously, but I frankly find that regime very impenetrable, and we fortunately have some greater experts here.
Well, the supreme religious leader in Iran, the supreme leader, as title might give you some idea of the extent of his powers, he has, in fact, been a very cautious man, indeed prone to being indecisive. And he has spent the last 18 years preferring a low-level confrontation with the West, which he despises, but not wanting to have a hot war. The current president of Iran, on the other hand, has argued that this is a moment when the United States in particular is so preoccupied elsewhere, and where Iran has such a strategic opportunity because of the high price of oil, because of the wave of support for their ideology, that Iran should adopt particularly truculent policies. And it would seem that the supreme leader has until now been prepared to let the president have considerable room in that direction because of the sense that there was no price to be paid for these very assertive policies. That these assertive policies, for instance, helped bring about a change in U.S. approach, which the previous reformist government was not able to achieve. So the sense that confrontation works is what led, seems to have led the Supreme Leader to be willing to allow these confrontational policies to proceed. However, that said, let me just note that the previous two presidents of Iran each came into office determined to try a new approach, in one case economic reform with Mr. Rafsanjani in 1989, in the other case political reform with Mr. Khatami in 1997, and the Supreme Leader allowed them to have a few years in which they got a little ways with what they were doing, but then pulled them back and did not allow them to proceed much further. And therefore, I remain relatively optimistic that if we can persuade the Supreme Leader that the confrontational approach of President Ahmadinejad is too dangerous, that this will be the third Iranian president in a row who finds that his hopes and dreams for fundamentally changing the Islamic Republic in a desired direction get stopped by the Supreme Leader and this deep state of these revolutionary institutions, which are indeed remarkably it's very difficult to get them to change from their policy direction, and their main policy direction has been one of low-level confrontation with the West, seeing how far you can get, but when you once you run up against a price, backing off of it.
That's the optimistic read. Let me also add a somewhat more pessimistic dimension, which is that there is a mood in ruling circles in Iran of Mahdaviyat, the anticipation of the Mahdi, the Muslim version of the Messiah, and the coming of the end of days. And in from this perspective, whether you win or lose, you win. Because if you win, you win, and if you lose, the end of days approaches. So there is a very, very dangerous mood. I don't know if it extends to the Supreme Leader Khamenei or not. No one really quite understands what's on his mind, but it is something very worrisome.
Yeah, but Daniel, that Mahdaviyat stuff, it's very worrisome, it's very troubling, and the attitude of the Supreme Leader and the top clergy like that is rather like Benedict XVI's attitudes towards the Rapture novels, which is this is folk religion, it's got nothing to do with what we're talking about here.
Well, where is the Soviet Union when you need it? Things were so much better in my time as a Sovietologist. By 1980, the last program that was articulated in the Soviet Union in the early 60s by Nikita Khrushchev, they said by 1980s, we're going to build communism. By 1980s, they had long queues for food. It was obvious that communism is not going to be built. Mahdi is not coming. And by 89, they were in terminal decline. So my question is, what needs to happen for that regime to realize that the Mahdi is not coming, the Islamic Revolution is not winning, and then hopefully to see the change of the regime in Tehran?
Well, certainly all of the social forces in Iran would suggest that the population has lost interest in the revolution and its values, so that the current president was able to win the last election, not by appealing to revolutionary values, but instead to economic populism, anti-corruption, and Iranian nationalism, all themes which were very foreign to the Islamic revolutionary values which he himself holds. And so he has only been able to come to get a certain degree of popular traction by appealing to things on which he cannot deliver, like this economic populist agenda, which is already starting to crash and burn. So the turn to an economic populist appealing to Iranian nationalism was, to my mind, an act of desperation by a regime which finds its ideology overwhelmingly rejected by the Iranian people. The difficulty is that in Iran, unlike the Soviet Union, it seems that there's still a small minority of people who are quite prepared to kill in order to stay in power and have no problems about doing that and make that very clear. All concerned. So something has to crack at the top before ordinary Iranians are going to be prepared to risk going out in the streets and be politically active, because at the moment they are firmly convinced, I suspect correctly, that if there were mass demonstrations in Iran, that would lead to mass deaths, not to political change.
Something or somebody needs to crack at the top. We are unfortunately out of time. This was a fascinating discussion. I would like the panel to maybe offer some very short concluding thoughts, if you have any, if you want to, but maybe a minute each, max.
If within the Israeli political context, I see this very forceful response of the last 2 weeks as Ehud Olmert and his team asserting their defense and security credentials in order to make it possible for them to pull back from the West Bank. In other words, critics like myself would say, Israel withdrew from Lebanon in 2000, withdrew from Gaza in 2005. Guess where they've got wars now? But believers in unilateral withdrawal would say that it gave Israel legitimacy, as it has enjoyed the last few weeks, and it will be a third unilateral withdrawal will take place in the West Bank. So in Israeli context, this should be seen as strengthening Olmert's hand rather than weakening it if Israel does well for the next round of unilateral withdrawal.
It would be wonderful if there could be a ceasefire in Lebanon shortly, insofar as that ceasefire were a sustainable ceasefire. My concern is that a ceasefire, while Hezbollah still thinks that it's winning and it's on top, will become like the many ceasefires that we saw in the former Yugoslavia. You may recall that some of those lasted less than an hour. And I don't think there's much point in having a ceasefire which is not sustained, because there is the grave risk that Lebanon will spiral downwards into repeated bouts of violence. So before we have a ceasefire here, there's got to be a sustainable circumstances for maintaining that ceasefire, and I don't think that that has been created yet. That I don't see indications Hezbollah is prepared, in fact, to give up its objectives of renewing the violence as soon as conditions permit.
I'll just add a few quick points. If Hassan Nasrallah comes out of this standing, then his stand as the champion of the Arab fight against Israel and of radical Islam will be increased dramatically. This may be a price we have to pay if we can get a workable ceasefire, but it is something to be concerned about, and it makes him a more effective vessel, as Patrick described, for Iranian ambitions. And on a related note, if this distracts us from the real issue, which is Iran's move towards nuclear capability, then it's a very important and dangerous situation, because that is, I believe, one of the essential questions about the future of the Middle East, a nuclear Iran.
Another excellent panel at the Heritage Foundation. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Let's give our panelists a round of applause.